Welcome back to Dakota Midday, Science Friday, and Tech Radio with the Computer Guys. Kent Osborne is off this week. I'm Keely Boltina. Just a reminder, you're welcome to call in or send us an email if you have a question for our experts. The number is 800-524-3604. That's 800-524-3604. Or you can email midday at sdpb.org. You know them and you love them. Our regular panel of tech experts is with us from our KCSD studio on the campus of the University of Sioux Falls. They are Joel Brovelite, Mac and Apple expert. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
John T. Meyer, CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
Jeff Litterick, Technology Integration Specialist with the State of South Dakota, joining us from Pierre. You there, Jeff?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us. And Amos Asa, sales engineer at SDN Communications here in Sioux Falls. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
So we were talking about different topics that we should cover today, and we kind of talked ahead of time, and then everybody walked in, and Joel piped up and said, we should probably talk net neutrality. And the entire room went, oh, yeah. So
it's not sexy. But it's
whatever we were going to do, let's drop that and do something else.
Well, if it's that big of a deal, then we might as well start with it.
You better.
Amos, you're going to give us a little bit of a primer. What is net neutrality for those of us lay people?
So the quick and easy version is that it's the idea that the internet should be available across the board equally and for the same price, regardless if you're a huge behemoth like Google or a small mom and pop shop, and that internet service providers should not be able to charge you more for doing things like streaming Netflix simply because you're using more bandwidth than a user who may be on Amazon.com and shopping.
And essentially it is status quo today.
Yes.
It's what we're used to for the last 20 years.
It's not making any changes. The idea is to not make changes to what we have today, yes.
And yeah, one and little thing I'd add is also to make sure that an ISP does not artificially speed up or slow down competitor services. A Comcast may slow down Netflix but speed up their own streaming service.
Yeah, you know, that is probably the biggest deal is I think consumers, of course, are rightfully afraid that, you know, without net neutrality, which basically because of that court ruling, there is no net neutrality anymore.
Well, so
it's over.
Yeah, we explained what net neutrality is. Maybe we should also say what happened last
week.
Yeah,
and so of course, consumers are afraid that, you know, their prices might vary depending on their usage. That's true. But the big deal is that ISPs and business users...
ISPs, internet service providers.
Internet service providers and businesses could actually... regulate their own bandwidth. They might decide if you're a Cox cable subscriber, you know, you're going to get a really slow speed because they have a deal with AT&T, or Facebook might go ahead and pay Mid-Continent. I'm not saying any of this is going to happen or has happened, but might pay Mid-Continent to have a faster service for theirs and then slow down Google Plus. That might be a totally within the law right now, and that's really the scary part, I think.
So is this this ruling that overturned the FCC's 2010 rules, this is good for consumers, it's bad for consumers? How does it impact me?
Boy, I think there's an argument both ways, although the majority argument would probably be that it's bad for consumers because now the way you utilize the internet, it's not a buffet anymore. Now it's going to be a la carte, and you're going to have to pay more for those services should that ISP deem it so. You know, one of the things that I was thinking of as you were explaining that, Joel, was that what if a service provider A, who might have a hosting service, has websites on their service, and ISP B doesn't care for that, so they slow all those websites down that are coming from that direction. It gives problems to the
and one of the things to keep in mind, because this is kind of what prompted this also, is many ISPs, luckily here in South Dakota we don't have very many, except for the cell, have data caps. And what happened was Comcast has a data cap for their cable customers. You can only do so much without paying extra per month. And what they were doing is they started exempting their own services but enforcing it for everybody else. So if you're a Netflix user, you could easily hit the data cap and have to pay more, but if you switch to the Comcast streaming, you would hit your data cap and it would be a la carte. So that was already in place and prompted kind of this big uproar that led to the court cases and stuff too. So, and the original rulings back then too. So that may also, you may see that especially on wireless carriers happen where this video service doesn't impact your data cap, but all others will.
So just for argument's sake, let me play devil's advocate here.
Yeah, let's hear it.
If I am surfing Amazon.com and I buy stuff and I go to my local news sites and that sort of stuff, and that's really all I do, why should I have to pay as much for my internet service as you, who streams Pandora all day long and at night watches 4 Netflix movies? You're using so much more bandwidth than I am. Why can't I get my rate cheaper and you pay for what you use?
You know, and that is a great argument. I've heard that before. That's kind of comparing it. It'd be tantamount to, say,
cable TV.
Yeah,
or
more like power companies,
sure,
or
sure,
gasoline, or utility that everybody uses. And that's true. The problem with that is the average low-end user right now uses 10 times more data than they did just 2 or 3 years ago. So if you're just using email or internet, you're browsing maybe to Facebook, you're doing a few things, and the other person in your example is streaming 4 movies, they're both using kind of 4 to 10 times the amount of data than they were just a couple of years ago, which if you put a law into place or a rule like that, or you, in this case, you take away all laws and rules governing that, that doesn't have any look forward ability for it. You know,
well, do you think
the internet goes? Go ahead. Yeah.
Is that the impetus for the law? Like they're realizing, oh crap, we're missing out on a ton of business opportunity by just giving all this internet away equally.
Yeah, and one of the big things that led to this, besides that Comcast streaming issue, was a lot of the ISPs, though it doesn't really impact consumers, want to reverse charges. So, you know, Google and Netflix are the biggest backbone internet pipes to your home, right? So the local ISPs want to go and charge them more so that they can gain access to your house because they're the ones eating up the bandwidth. Remember that web surfer that only eats up a little bit from Amazon? But if he goes to Netflix, he eats up a whole bunch more. ISPs want to charge Netflix for that incoming traffic. And that is something that is brand new in the whole internet kind of architecture and pricing scheme.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and then there's potential, at least from the outside that I see, of what happens in other industries where if Netflix is being charged more, then they're not going to take the cut on their bottom line. They're going to pass it on to me, who's
absolutely
just trying to watch, you know, a web series.
And that's exactly the type of person that it's going to affect. It's not going to likely directly affect you. The ISPs aren't going to start charging you. But what's going to happen is the usage that you have is going to be very variable, I should say. And that Netflix that you want to use, it's not that they could charge Netflix, you know, Comcast or Midcontinent or whatever. They're going to. With this ruling being overturned, they are already putting plans in to say, okay, well, Netflix is the largest user of bandwidth in the United States, which is true. So let's go ahead and charge them accordingly.
It's very anti-competitive because the biggest ISPs outside of Cell are cable companies in the United States, which are offering competing service directly to the people they want to charge. And as you can see, that leads kind of down the rabbit hole real fast, where analogy is if you buy a Ford, Ford will pay for from certain gas stations for free, and you never have to pay gas for your car. But if you don't buy a Ford, you always have to pay gas. Well, who's sure going to buy anything except a Ford? I mean, it becomes very anti-competitive very fast.
I think it's a big deal because it's so counterculture to how we've all grown to know the internet. You know, we know that, like, if I'm in Sioux Falls or if I'm a person in Sioux Falls or in Senegal, I should, barring a few maybe differences and variance in speed of the internet, should be able to get the same content, the same information. You know, it's equal. And that was the power of the internet, that it was so global. And
yeah, or more germanely, if you're on the north side of Sioux Falls, you're getting the same speed, you know, depending on your equipment and your usage that a person, you know, on the south side is.
No.
What about specifically applying this to South Dakota? I mean, we're still working to make sure that everybody in South Dakota is even connected on, like, the most basic level. So this feels like it's an additional, there could be an additional barrier to
a
people
hurdle,
having access.
Well, absolutely. If it gets to the point where where we're having to charge for those sorts of things. I happen to work for an ISP, and I
crazy
know
how that happens.
Weird, huh? Yeah.
Convenient.
And I know it's one of those things that actually the way I'm picturing in the back of my mind is, what then do you get when you have ISPs that are doing this, and now maybe an ISP says, you know what, we're not going to rate limit any of your things. We're not going to. And you'll see these floods. You'll see people moving back and forth. I'm almost thinking of it as like the remember back in the day when we had landline phones and you had like the 10-cent a minute commercials, yeah, and the 5-cent, yeah, a minute commercials? You'll start to see that a lot too, rather than I just get internet service for my particular ISP and I can still access the same thing no matter which one I go to.
That's a good point.
Just seems like freer, more widespread competition, which is beneficial.
And
for
I think
everybody.
What's interesting, you know, us educating the audience here on this topic is, remember, like maybe it was over a year ago when we talked about SOPA and PIPA, you know, mm-hmm, and
that it was just about a year ago, exactly.
Was it?
Yeah.
And the internet went crazy, right? Like some of the biggest websites blacked out their website. There was like one-click buttons where you could send a letter to your senator. You know, it was really the internet made it really easy to uprise and to start a movement. I haven't seen that yet.
Well, the big deal is that was legislation that was trying to be passed.
Sure.
This is a court ruling, so there's really no amount of lobbying that one could do to change the outcome of, you know,
well,
court ruling.
One thing to remember, though, too, is the cause is not lost. There are other ways the FCC, by enforcing ISPs to become common carriers, that can reestablish and enforce the regulation. So while the court struck it down because of the language fixes and certain things by the FCC can actually go in and fix that. And also the Federal Trade Commission can step in and do some regulations and stuff here too. So while the court struck this down, we'll have to wait and see the true impact later, because there'll be some rearranging of language and stuff to try to get the regulation back in compliance that the judges are happy with.
So we shouldn't be so scared?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know.
It's like, it's like, to be continued.
I'm like, okay, this works. Okay, this doesn't make any sense. Okay, this sounds like a good plan. Uh-oh.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of news and legislation maybe putting forth. One of the easiest things to do, and it's up in the air as to whether this is going to happen, is the FCC decides, the Federal Communication Commission, if they decide to rule that the internet or broadband is a common carrier, because it was up until, I think, 2005 or 2008, and then that was removed. Common carrier, for those that don't understand, it's the same like a telephone. Everybody should have access to telephone, water. You know, back in the day, it was rail line,
sure,
roads, so everybody should have access to that. Right now, internet is not a common carrier. So it could be very easy if the FCC decided to do that.
And this ruling feels like it steps to the other side of it. You mentioned in the beginning talking about other things, considering internet yet like a utility, but it feels like this ruling gives potential to swing past this, well, it's based on usage, but we're going to be somewhat reasonable about it, to an area that could be abusive.
Yeah, there are very, there are very possibly great reasons to have this ruling go this way. I mean, it could innovate lots of things. I'm not saying it's wholly bad. I just personally think that if given the option, ISPs and or Google is going to use their incredible leverage. Google, Apple, Microsoft use their incredible leverage to do what they do and cause people to say, hey, if you favor us, we'll give you a kickback, or you know, we'll make it easier for you, and that does nothing for people that say maybe want to sell their art on their own website or,
yeah,
or you know, want to run a taxi service.
I think it's important to note too, for all of the arguments we've made against, or I'm sorry, for net neutrality, and that's kind of where some of the ambiguity comes in. There weren't any ISPs that were sitting out there waiting for this ruling to happen so that they could start doing these, making these charges. Nothing has come of this yet. It's just now it's available. And, you know, as ISPs were to start doing this, they'd have a difficult time with the backlash. So I'm not too concerned about having to pay extra money next week for my ISP.
Sure.
Nor is Netflix, I don't believe, although they just see this as an open door to that possibility.
Sure. So it's a good thing to pay attention to, but not something that's going to impact us tomorrow. We just can't ignore it and then react later on.
Hope it goes away, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Jeff Litterick, did you have anything else on the phone to add about net neutrality?
No. It's just one of those things we've been living with and kind of assumed for a while. It will be a game changer depending on how stuff goes, but impact's not going to be for a couple years at minimum.
Okay, so a big deal, but not a hugely quick impact on anything. That seems like a pretty natural place to take a quick break. We will go ahead and step away from our tech experts for a moment. I'm Keely Boltina in for host Kent Osborne, and we will be back in just a moment with more Tech Radio right here on SDPB. Welcome back to Dakota Midday Science Friday. We are back to Tech Radio with the computer guys and me. I'm Keely Boltina. I'm filling in for host Kent Osborne, who is off this week. Our last bit of conversation went a little bit doom and gloom, guys. So let's avoid that a little bit and focus on Facebook. There has been some talks. A study came out from a couple of Princeton researchers that says Facebook will be dead by 2017. We have Jeff Litterick, who is on the phone from Peer. Why don't you start us off? Tell us about this Facebook study that's been done.
Well, as a side note, Facebook just released a study of their own before we went on that says Princeton will be dead by 2020. what it is, and who knows if the model's accurate, though it has kind of been proven in other cases for online kind of social websites where they feed in the usage patterns, and many of the social media site usage patterns kind of follow the path of an epidemic. So what they did was they put Facebook's usage numbers into a computer model that predicts epidemics like flu and other health problems. And if it follows the pattern, Facebook won't be dead but will have shed at least most of its active users by 2017 in terms of using the website. And for a site like Facebook or anything, that you know, that is the death knell, because you really need people interacting or no one's going to use your website. It's kind of an avalanche kind of effect. Kind of happened to MySpace when Facebook came out, and there have been previously a lot of studies about especially younger folks not using Facebook, not even signing up or getting off of it and using other social sites like Snapchat, Pinterest, and other ones. So, and it does, it kind of follows that same kind of epidemic pattern. So it will be interesting to see what happens over time.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff's the technology integration specialist with the state of South Dakota. He's in Peer. In studio, we have Mac and Apple expert Joel Brovelite, sales engineer at SDN Communications, Amos Asub, and our resident social media guru, John T. Meyer. He's the CEO of Emily. So when we are talking about Facebook, I've taken the study. I'm listening to it.
Sure.
It's interesting, but I also know that I can't for the life of me get my mother off of Facebook. So
yeah, I mean, Jeff's exactly right when he described it. You have numbers reports saying that teenagers are leaving it, some not even signing up. He's right that users is one thing. We know they have over a billion. So if you consider the people who can even join Facebook, you're technically not supposed to join it until you're 13. I mean, Facebook has a huge percentage of the world using their product. But the real numbers that everyone's looking at is active users. So how many people go on and use the site every day? And it's still very, very high. But there's a reason why they offered $3 billion in cash to purchase, you know, Snapchat, and they said no. They want to find more ways to reach that teenage market. And so, you know, some people say they're turned off because their mom or their grandma is on Facebook.
Mine are.
Yeah, that's actually one of the number one reasons kids say that they don't use Facebook is because you know, they can't have their own community, you know. Imagine having, when we were kids, having your mom, you know, in on your friend discussions
sure.
at school. What a nightmare.
The thing that Jeff so described, true. Kind of that epidemic kind of viral nature, is kind of called, that's called network effect. So the reason that it took a while for Facebook to grow is everyone had their friends over at MySpace. But one, you know, because you can join, there will always be another Facebook. We've always said that. But at first, it's a matter of you can't just be there by yourself. You need to bring your network with you. And so that's sometimes friction. It takes time. The internet has made it easier to do that. That's why when you sign up for Snapchat or Instagram, it says, hey, would you like to bring your Facebook friends or sync your Twitter contacts? And all of a sudden, you pull your whole network with you. And so, I don't know. I think I would say yes. Will Facebook die? Yes, just because I think there'll always be something better. And then after that, there'll be something better. But putting it by 2017, who knows?
And it doesn't mean that social networks have to be mutually exclusive. I mean, just because I sign up for whatever's next after Facebook doesn't mean that I leave my Facebook behind.
Absolutely, yeah.
So can you really?
The key is which one do you use? That's the point. That's where the money is. So that's exactly like you said. It's active users.
Well, and a big part of it is now is mobile, which we always talk about. So who's creating the best mobile experience? So Snapchat is a mobile only product right now. Well, until this week, actually, they announced that you can do Snapchats on your desktop, which will mean even more selfies. But
and more moms and dads.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, so they're more concerned about, are you using the mobile product? Are you using Twitter on your phone or Facebook on the go, Snapchat? You know, because that's how we are now going to start using our social networks moving forward. You might be signed up for 10 things, but what do you use?
Well, you know, and I've noticed, too, that I'm actually using my Facebook account as my login for other smaller, more specific social networks. But like that, I just joined in on your Fitbit trend thing. And based on the login there, I use my Facebook to log in. And so I think Facebook sees that and tries to continue to keep themselves relevant by offering that service.
And I think they will. Their life expectancy will be longer because of that.
Yeah, and that's why I don't buy into this prediction. Famously, Michael Dell said that, about, I think, 9 years ago that Apple should liquidate the company and give all the money back to the shareholders because it was such a dismal company. And now Michael Dell is trying to buy back his company. Same thing with Facebook. If Facebook does nothing, yes, of course, it's going to fold. But Facebook has tons of leverage, tons of users, and tons of money. They're going to leverage that. Will we see Facebook like we have now in 3 years? Probably not. But it'll be something else. Maybe it won't even be called Facebook.
Well, Snapchat said no to $3 billion. Will they say no to $4 or $5?
Well, yeah, but that's assuming Snapchat is the end all be all. Of course, there's somebody else working on something in a Starbucks right now that's going to be 3 times as good, and maybe they'll offer $10 billion, or who knows what they'll do. Apple, which I'm just going to quick mention, is the 30th anniversary of the Macintosh.
He was going to work
today.
It in here somewhere.
You know, I was going to work it in today.
My mom tweeted that to me from. It was on the Today Show this morning. So
yeah.
it's big news.
He's got the
iPad and the Air in front of him, the iPhone in the little case. So it was only a matter of time.
But my point with that was not to plug Apple, even though I love to do that.
Right.
Is that, 30 years ago, Apple, their flagship, well, actually more like 25 years ago, their flagship product was the Macintosh. However, if you know Apple now, the Macintosh is probably not even on your radar. It's a phone. It's a tablet.
Sure.
It might be online services. So Facebook just needs to do that, and I predict they will.
Jeff Litterick, do you agree that it's a matter of Facebook morphing to stay relevant? Is that something that you think is possible too?
Maybe more than a morph. I mean, if you look at the Apple, they kind of reinvented themselves and changed kind of directions and cart the market and looked ahead of everybody else. And that's what Facebook will probably have to do. The Facebook will have to change itself and also be the Snapchat of the future. I mean, the problem is big companies tend to move slowly. Apple had the benefit that you had Steve Jobs, who just hammered stuff down, and it was a very kind of flattened decision-making. We'll see if Facebook keeps following that or if they start getting too big and too weighty kind of to move fast enough, because they're going to have to, have a vision going forward that is revolutionary, that everyone wants to follow it. If they don't, it will. Otherwise, they will still be around.
Well, if we're looking for things that are revolutionary, let's transition to talking about Jelly, which is an app that I will admit, because I am not in this sphere, I had to search online to find out about. So I feel like this is one of those up-and-coming things, those next things that you're going to start seeing people talking about. Who wants to volunteer to explain what Jelly is, John T. Meyer?
Sure. So Jelly came out, I think, 2 weeks ago. And
okay, so I'm not that far behind. It wasn't
two years ago. No, this is new. This is very new. Not the concept of Jelly, but an app called Jelly. And essentially it was made by thanks for the ba-dum-ching, silent.
Yeah.
But one of the co-founders of Twitter, his name is Biz Stone. We've now had the co-founders of Twitter go on to make Square, Jack Dorsey, now Jelly. His new co-founder started this idea with the concept of, with my network and my community, can I answer questions, get insight, get opinions through pictures? So the idea is, I think their explainer video, you're walking outside and you take a picture of a really interesting tree on a hike, and then you share it with your network through Facebook and Twitter, like we're talking about already. And people will respond with, what is this? it's a spruce. Oh, it's an oak. No, actually, that's a poisonous tree. Like, don't eat those berries. You know, things like that, by using photos to kind of crowdsource answers and opinions. When I signed up as a Curiosity, my wife and I were looking for a blender that we wanted to make like smoothies with. And so I was at the store and I took a picture of one that I had been recommended to me by somebody. And I said, I hear this is good, a good blender. Is it, does it work for smoothies? And I sent it out, and within 2 hours, I had 17 answers, I think, from some strangers and some people I knew with opinions. Oh, get a Vitamix or get this or do that.
But that would, that would indicate that you had 17 friends on one of your social networks who also had Jelly installed. Is that accurate?
So what they've done, yeah, because otherwise, you're right, it's a chicken and egg thing, right? So you, people sign up, who's going to answer if there's no one there?
Right.
What they did, though, is like we just talked about that network effect. So if Joel might not be on Jelly, but if Joel follows me on Twitter and one of Joel's friends is on Jelly, they could answer my question.
Oh,
so okay. It's a little bit, I wouldn't say anonymous, but you have strangers answering your questions.
Yeah, there are definitely degrees of separation.
Exactly.
There.
It's kind of a little bit like, Kevin Bacon.
And I think they'll roll it out. I downloaded the app. I think the first day it was available, I saw a splash on Apple's webpage because I liked the idea. If you've ever heard of the service Shazam, it was probably one of the first apps available for the iPhone and for other phones before that. What it does is it takes a listen to an audio, a song that you might be listening to, and it uses a complicated algorithm and a database to figure out what song it is, which I think is one of the coolest apps ever. I use it all the time.
Cool.
I love it. And is Jelly's very much like
SoundHound?
That.
SoundHound?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, perfect.
Exactly.
I'm still cool.
Yeah, absolutely. SoundHound's way cooler than
Totally.
For sure.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So, but with Jelly.
With Jelly, it kind of takes that away from having a service do it, and it makes it a crowdsource thing, which I think is super brilliant. You know, there are, the blender question that John came up with, you know, that there's tons of people that have the answer to that question. And I think they're rolling it out small. Right now it's you have to have Jelly or somebody you know has to have Jelly installed. I suspect they're rolling it out small so that they don't get too many users and get too bogged down too quickly, which is very smart. I suspect if it takes off, you'll see that widen over the next year, maybe two, much like Twitter does.
And, you know, what's going to happen is it'll probably morph like Shazam. I don't know if you've noticed, but Shazam actually is promoted on commercials that says use Shazam to listen to this commercial and then go to a webpage with more information. And it allows you to expand on that. And that's probably something that wasn't even thought of when they first began Shazam.
Oh, of course not.
And
yeah.
So the same thing will happen here where the usage will kind of morph into more and more things.
So they call it a human-powered discovery and search engine driven by images. And yesterday they announced they had raised their Series B round, which just means a large round of investment. Numbers were not disclosed, but it's getting some traction already.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be great. You know, it's really hard to describe to somebody on Twitter, hey, what's that big, tall, spiky thing in the middle of Brookings, South Dakota that looks like the Washington Monument? It's so long, nobody's going to necessarily read that. If you got a picture of it, you might just browse by it. Okay, I know what it is. It's Campanile. Done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a brilliant idea. Brilliant idea.
I'm just trying to figure out when I would use it. I
sure.
mean, it seems like one of the pushes for this is, oh, well, you can conduct research. You really can crowdsource. But how am I, if that's not my business, how am I going to integrate that into my daily life as opposed to Facebook where I just kind of want to find out what other people are doing?
Yeah, it may not integrate that way. You know, one of the ways I can see it taking off quickly is the same way Twitter did with, say, in the Middle East with the Arab Spring.
Yep.
You know, if somebody uses Jelly to take a shot of, you know, okay, I mean, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but this is going to happen. You know, there's a guy who's bleeding out of his arm. Somebody takes a shot, and then three doctors answer it and say, do this, do this, do this. I mean, I can see that being really valuable service.
You do have, yeah, you think of Twitter as a platform and how it grew. The Arab Spring was a really defining moment in kind of the life cycle or the storytelling of that product. And who knows? I could see something like that happening with Jelly. I agree. I don't think it's going to like change your day-to-day life today. But it's interesting, and we'll see how it works. You know, it's kind of, BizStone came out of Twitter, but also Twitter released their own product about a year ago, Vine as well. You know, so Vine was kind of making these 6-second videos, these looped kind of videos, which you saw Instagram react by adding video to their product. And so it's always going to be a game of tug of war with these social networks. Like maybe the concept of Jelly is what's brilliant, but the app isn't the one that wins. Something
exactly.
else comes later. But it always helps to have money and have press. And Bono is an investor, too, of Jelly. So if that means anything to you.
He's got lots of irons in the fire.
Jeff Litterick, do you see other avenues where this could be integrated? Or is this just something that's going to be for fun for a while until people really secure a use for it?
Well, it's going to be one of really two things like most social media stuff does. It will be fun for a time and then something else will come along and everyone will move from it and be forgotten. Or the users themselves, the people using it, will come up with the unique, you know, killer app, so to speak, or killer use of the service. In many ways, I mean, look at Facebook, even MySpace back in the day. They have morphed based because their users decided to use a service in a way that was unpredicted in many ways. So it's really when you get that many users, they come up with their own usages, and if they're good enough, people will stay and keep using.
Yeah, Jeff's exactly right. You know, the initial version of Twitter didn't have a retweet button that became. People would actually copy and paste the tweet and put RT in front of it as a way to kind of like give credit. And then, of course, that button became a thing. So the users do often shape the product.
Well, hopefully Jelly can stay away from the concept of the fail whale, because I remember that
True.
Too. I was in on Twitter. See, I'm slowly learning these things. As we continue with this part, let's transition to another topic yet, and we're talking about Nest. Who's going to tackle this for us? John T. Meyer again. It's the John T. Meyer show today.
I just want him to say it because I know I'm going to drone on and on about it, so I don't want to.
Well, Nest isn't new on our show. I think 2 years in a row we've talked about it as a holiday, a recommendation. You know a product works when a 20-year-old kid in his apartment or the 65-year-old guy at his cottage loves the product, and that's why Nest got acquired by Google last week for $3.2 billion, billion with a B, in cash.
And what is Nest? What is this
So
product?
Nest is a company that builds kind of smart utility products for your home. So their lead product was called the Nest, kind of self-titled album, and it was a thermostat, a smart thermostat that you can hook up in place of your old thermostat. And then using internet, you can control it remotely from your phone. It'll learn your habits to know when you usually go to work, cool down your apartment. When you come back, it'll heat it up.
Joel is demonstrating as
is
you
he?
Speak.
He's probably turning the heat on right now at his house.
I think he just turned it down, actually.
Turned it down, okay.
But he
your
keeps
wife's
his
like,
higher.
What did he do?
Right?
That's exactly. Probably what's happening.
And, you know, we actually, at the facility I work at, we actually are moving all of our thermostats to Nest. It allows our facilities management guys to be able to access those remotely, to be able to see what temperatures are in various locations. And it's just proved to be a better platform than the standard go over and move the dial with your finger.
Yeah, or the terrible web interface that a lot of, like, a Honeywell has. This is a really clunky web interface.
I think what prompted the acquisition then is, they wanted to make sure Nest, Google, they wasn't a one-trick pony. And so then this fall they also came out with, it was called the Nest Protect, which was their
smoke alarm.
Yeah. So now they were able to redesign these traditionally very boring and unsexy things in a consumer-friendly way that's very brilliant. Well, and now
maybe even more friendly than the one that's been used for 50 years. I know that the Nest, using the thermostat, you know, my 5-year-old, 4-year-old knows how to turn up and down the heat. You know, you don't have to go into a sub menu. You don't have to. She knows how to set it to we're leaving the house. It's just amazing. Are you using the Nest Protect as well?
I have not done that. I actually had just replaced all of the smoke detectors.
No, I mean, is the office using those?
Oh, no, the office is not.
I bought the Nest Protect right when it came out, and I also think it's an amazing product, and I told this story when we talked about it. I was, this was Christmas, and I was going to pick up a last-minute Christmas gift, and my wife didn't know how to use it. And all of a sudden, my phone blows up with a text and an email that there's a fire at my house because I had left a pizza box in the oven and turned the oven on for them, and it was on fire. And it was amazing because I could call and make sure everything was okay, and because I couldn't get there in time.
I'm sure this was covered, but pizza box oven?
I know, it was
okay,
totally
I'll
covered.
I'll let it go. But I do...
You shouldn't.
Like,
it was terrible. My wife didn't let it go.
The regular Nest, to me, you know, my husband talked about it when it first came out. Oh, this is cool. It learns your habits. It, you know, you can control it from afar. And I was kind of like, whatever.
Sure.
But I really like this concept of bringing in like a safety and security aspect to it and letting me know things like that as opposed to just the basic inner workings of the house. I think that's an advantage.
And it saves tons of money. You know, I went to Kansas City this last weekend with my family and we left. It turns itself down to a safe amount, 55 degrees at our house. And then when we're rolling into Omaha on our way back, you know, 3 hours later, I go check and it says 57 degrees in our house. I'm like, whoa. So I just turn it up. By the time we walk in the house, it's 69 degrees. Perfect. And
it's pretty easy to sell a $250 product when you can say you'll save 10 bucks every month on your heating bill.
Yeah, it paid for ours the first year.
What's the next thing that they go with? Like a doorbell or...
you know, I think maybe a door lock, a remote
door
entry
lock.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know that. I'm just... That seems logical. That seems like an area that needs to be done.
I would not have guessed smoke detector, so...
So the number is interesting. That gets headlines, $3.2 billion. But now...
Which is a lot.
Probably more interesting is who bought them, right? So Google... So now what is Google, how are they making this as a play? It's not just like, hey, Nest is cool, we'll give you $3 billion. Yeah, they have the money, but that's a lot of money. So what is their play? How are they going to use it?
And do they make it more like the doorbot, which, you know, when you said doorbell, it made me think, mm-hmm. well, maybe there will be a camera there that you can see who's there but without even going to the door. I don't know.
And in Nest terms of use, terms of agreement, they say we do not use your data, you know, to advertise or market to you in any way. And so far in the acquisition, they've said that's going to remain the same. But,
and they actually even said they wouldn't share the data with Google as a whole. It stays within that some company even after the purchase.
Yep, that's the plan. So, someday would they say, hey, we know that you keep a house, you're a pretty cool house. I'm going to serve some ads for you for an electric blanket, for a nice jacket, for a space heater. You know?
Yeah, hard to tell. I mean, I think Google made a smart move. You know, every... major company, whether it's Microsoft, Apple, Google, Facebook, they want to get into internet-enabled devices. And Nest probably, in my opinion, did a better job than anyone else making it easy to use, making the price point, I think, very reachable, and making a really nice-looking product. And Google's like, you know, let's not try and reinvent the wheel here. Let's go with somebody that really knows what they're doing. And I think that was a good move. I kind of wish Apple had done it, frankly.
And it's going to be one of the big growth factors as they go more and more into the whole home automation future where, you know, security system, window sensors, the video camera on the front door, the back door, the refrigerator, the stove. I mean, as everything gets connected into home automation suites, Nest is kind of the leader in the whole area and is going to be the market focus for the next few years at least.
I just think you mentioned Honeywell, who's been making thermostats for
over 100 years.
You got to be sitting there that day when you read $3.2 billion and be like, "What did we do?"
Yeah,
wrong?
And that's what they made last year.
Yeah, and remember, from a corporate level, many of the state buildings and other corporate buildings already have had these systems, kind of like what Nest is doing for many a year now. But it's now moving into the home. And even further, where you automate your lighting systems and everything into one complete, user-friendly system. So it's not new. It's just coming kind of to the home user.
Sure, into our everyday lives. That sounds good. Let's take a short break. We will be back with the Computer Guys right here on Tech Radio. It's South Dakota Public Broadcasting. It is Friday again, and that means it is Science Friday here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and you are listening to Tech Radio with the Computer Guys. Let's do the rundown, because I keep forgetting to explain your names repeatedly. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kent Osborne. We have Joel Brovelite, who's our Mac and Apple expert. John T. Meyer, who's the CEO of Lemonly here in Sioux Falls. Jeff Litterick's on the phone from Peer. He's the technology integration specialist for the state of South Dakota. And Amos Asup is sales engineer at SDN Communications. We just have about 10 minutes left in our show today. Things have gone quickly. And we're going to talk a little bit about programming, coding. I don't know if I can use those words interchangeably or if I'm not allowed. and I don't know why I'm here because John T. Meyer is just going to intro every subject in this show.
No,
so
no.
Why don't you talk to us about this push for coding and programming, especially in young people, high schoolers and college students, things like that.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating time today. and when we talk about programming as a programming language, because I really think that's what, how you think of it. It's like learning Spanish or learning German. It's learning a new language. And what we're seeing is across the country in multiple different ways, you have online learning programs like Code Academy, Treehouse, Coursera, Skillshare, that people can now learn these things for cheap to free on their computers. Or you're also seeing now these little code schools pop up. So I know like Omaha is starting one this spring called the Omaha Code School, and you could pay $6,000 and you go to school for 12 weeks, 8 to 5, as like almost like a job. But when you think of like an opportunity cost, I mean, six grand and 12 weeks of your time, as opposed to, you know, maybe going to a university and not sure what you want to do. And that's a whole nother argument, but it's a fascinating time right now to learn this skill.
And there are places where these people who have this training can go immediately to get work. I mean, this is a fast-growing sector needs programmers.
You can come in as an accountant and 12 weeks later be hired as a junior developer.
You know, the interesting thing is that all of the stuff that we've talked about previously today all has coders behind it. There are so many jobs. It's only getting bigger from here. Everything we talk about every time on this show always has somebody behind it who knows some programming language that they're utilizing to create these apps. And, you know, the fact that they're starting to give away this information, the fact that you don't have to pay, like that online course I was happen to be looking at was a programming mobile applications for Android handheld systems, which is a free course given off of Coursera, started a couple days ago. You know, that's just how ubiquitous this is becoming, that it's a commodity they're just giving away now because everybody needs it. And you alluded to the idea that 25 years ago, one of the skills you had to have was keyboarding or using the typewriter.
Absolutely.
This is just an evolution of that, I believe.
Absolutely.
I really need to know how to code?
I think if you're in high school now, or certainly if you're in grade school or middle school now, learning how to code is just as important as learning how to use a computer or type, because the computer and the typing part are already taken care of. You don't need to teach kids that because they already know it.
Class. Maybe it's doesn't not already.
It shouldn't be if it isn't. But, you know, programming, it's just going to be more ubiquitous. Whatever job you have, you're going to have to at least know the nuts and bolts of how things work. And even if it's just an intro class.
Yeah, you might not be building jelly, but you need to understand so we could sit here and talk about it. Like just like I said, the analogy of learning Spanish or German.
Yeah, and we've got business systems analysts who don't do coding, but when they sit down and they try to project manage a large project that involves a lot of coding and the developers are talking about the different languages that they're using, it helps for that manager to understand at least the fundamentals when it comes to what does it take to make the underlying foundation of Jelly work? How much effort does that require? And so it's good to at least have the foundation.
Yeah, it's not even a question that we want kids to be able to read or do math. I think this is the same thing.
And it's more than just writing the code so that the computer does what it's supposed to or that the app does what it's supposed to do. Jeff Litterick, weigh in on that when it comes to programming and offering the backbone to a lot of these services we use almost constantly.
Well, you know, I can only kind of expand on what they've already said in that you can't look at a device anymore that's not a coder behind it or a code has been running on it. Or, you know, create your own private space, your own websites, blogs, WordPress, no matter what, without at least needing to know and understand how the coding works. It's becoming saturated kind of to the point in our life where, I mean, everything, even the most unique little piece of hardware out there, little drone needs software in order to work and coding, and it's just going to be kind of every day with us. It's just going to, you know, be that. And that's, if you really want, you know, the good careers and stuff, you're going to need to know that because we are moving more and more into the information age, and that is what required. I mean, even to manufacture hardware, you need to understand coding.
Yeah, right now it's so, very much the haves and the have-nots when it comes to either knowing or not knowing code.
Even if you do a manufacturing job, almost all of it's CNC machines. Those are programmed with languages, just like coding of what you consider an app, by machinists to produce the parts. So the coding even gets you, I mean, into everything you might not even suspect. So if you're going to go be a machinist someplace, you're going to have to learn coding of CNC machines. So if you have the basic understandings, and it's like learning multiple languages. The second one's the hardest. The third one is much easier. Fourth is even easier and stuff. You know the basic knowledge philosophy. You're going to need to know that for any job in the future.
All right, guys, last call. You've got 2 minutes. Anything else we need to throw on the table for our audience to understand tech news, exciting things?
Yeah, we could definitely tease the next time. And, of course, everything will completely change by the next time. But one of the things that I think is
code won't matter in 2 weeks. So.
is the recent credit card hacking thing with Target, Neiman Marcus. There's a big push now to standardize the magnetic strip that only the people in the U.S. and like one other country in Africa uses, to the chip and pin standard, which basically everybody else on the planet uses. Why we don't have that already, I have no
idea.
They
see a lot less fraud.
It's the same reason we still have CDMA. We just the non-metric system, whatever that's called. What is that called?
Imperial,
yeah. It's just we refuse to conform. That's what it is.
The FBI even released a warning a little bit earlier this week that they expect many more retailers to have been hit. This is not going to be an isolated case with Target and Neiman Marcus. So something's going to have to happen.
Yeah, $70 million is, I think one of the headlines said, just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, absolutely.
That's Cash. Crazy.
Yeah, no paper trail, that's what my grandpa always said.
Yeah.
Farmer.
Yeah, would that were so. It's just not going to work that way, unfortunately.
And the businesses will start. I mean, look at Target. They've announced at least 500 to 600 jobs cut. Just because of this whole thing going on, or at least that's what they're blaming it on. So, it's going to impact a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of PR spin going on, too.
Of course.
Lots of impact. So the takeaways from today, learn code, try to understand net neutrality, and bury your cash in the backyard.
Yeah.
And get a nest.
By next week, not the kind you hatch eggs in, though.
Yes, not yet.
And if you need to ask a question, use Jelly and take a picture.